Welcome to Onc Life On Air. I'm your host today, Ryan Scott. Onc Life On Air is a podcast from Onc Life, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Life covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with Shikha Jain, MD, FACP, Assistant Professor of Medicine and Director of Communication Strategies in Medicine at the University of Illinois College of Medicine, Associate Director of Oncology Communication and Digital Innovation at UI Cancer Center, and Medical Oncologist in the Department of Hematology and Oncology at UI Health. Jain discussed an article she authored titled, "We Are Running Up the Wrong Side of the Escalator," which confronts systemic and structural obstacles facing women in medicine. In the article, Jain states that women hold less than 20% of the industry's leadership roles, despite comprising 80% of healthcare workers. She goes on to explore the reasons women physicians earn significantly less than men over their careers and are more likely to be passed over for promotions or career advancement despite working equal or more hours with similar workloads as their male counterparts. In our exclusive interview, Jain highlights how the system continues to plague women in medicine today, ways to enact lasting changes, the role of male allyship, the goals of the Women in Medicine Summit, and more. Thank you so much again, Dr. Jain, for being here with me today to speak on this important topic. In the article, you state women are running up the wrong side of the escalator. To start, could you elaborate on what you mean by that?
Well, when we talk about healthcare and women in medicine, women in healthcare, the challenge is when the system was created years and years and years ago, the majority of the workforce was not women. And so the healthcare workforce was structured in a way that was convenient for the people who were working within it, which was predominantly men. Now, what's happened over the years is more and more women have entered the workforce in general, and more women have entered into the healthcare workforce. And unfortunately, the same structures that were there at the onset of healthcare systems being invented are still in place now. And so we haven't evolved as a society or as a healthcare system to adapt to the fact that our healthcare workforce looks very different now than it did back pre-Civil War. And so the challenges that many women face and the inequities that are pervasive throughout our healthcare system are really based on the fact that we are working within a system that does not represent the people who are actually working in the system.
You spoke on how we're working in a system that wasn't necessarily made for us. So I wanted to ask, do you believe internalized misogyny could be at play here?
I absolutely do. I think the challenge is our society in general has been, we stereotypically believe that women are meant to be, you know, more domestic and doing more work at home. There are stereotypes that exist that come out in interviews where, for example, I've been told in interviews that I don't need to get paid as much as my husband because my husband is working, or I can do work for free because I'm not the primary breadwinner. So that type of behavior and that type of thinking is still present in the way we treat many women in the workforce today. And that is one of the contributing factors, I think, to the pay disparity we continue to see, as well as the fact that women often aren't tapped on the shoulder for leadership opportunities, despite the fact that they are equally, if not more qualified. They aren't offered opportunities to collaborate or to give keynote addresses. The disparities go on and on. And many times, most times, it's not because the women aren't qualified. It's because there's this internal and sometimes very external way of thinking about women in the workforce that directly impacts how we see women in their professional careers and how they're valued and how their work is valued.
So then moving forward, where does the onus lie in correcting these inequities we're seeing here?
Well, the real challenge is disrupting the healthcare system in a positive way and restructuring the system. Dr. Amy Gottlieb actually has a fantastic quote. I'm going to paraphrase here, but she states that the work that women do is essential to advancing healthcare systems, and it usually is the work that's most needed. Unfortunately, that type of work is undervalued, whether you're looking in the academic setting or if you're looking outside of the academic setting. That type of work is, you know, community building or collaborative work, running the diversity, equity, and inclusion committees, making sure that the mental health of trainees is taken care of. During this pandemic, a lot of it was unpaid work related to, you know, creating a new COVID floor on the unit in order to take care of overflow patients. So a lot of that work is essential. And a lot of the work that women are doing is really resulting in organizations getting either financial gains or getting awards. But that's not the work that we value when it comes to financial compensation or promotions. For example, in academia, the currency of academia is publications, it's generating RVUs, it's getting grant opportunities, getting leadership opportunities. Those are the types of things that many people dedicate time to. Unfortunately, when women who are doing the work that needs to be done, these joining these committees, leading different ways to improve the diversity of leadership, when they're doing that type of work is not valued, whether it's in compensation or whether it's in being considered for leadership. And so because of that, women are working twice as hard in many cases, but they aren't getting the return on investment, whether it's financial or whether it's in their career. And so until we reimagine and re-envision how we value our workers and the work they're putting in to our healthcare systems, we're not going to be able to change the system. Right now, the real challenge is figuring out what's working, what's not working, and what is outdated in the way our healthcare systems are run and how we're valuing our healthcare workers in the systems.
Looking to the COVID pandemic, how has this provided an opportunity to enact lasting changes?
Well, the COVID-19 pandemic has been a huge stress on everyone, and especially for those in the healthcare workforce, both men and women. And I want to make the point that this is not a topic where we talk about, you know, men versus women, or we say that this is a competition to see who's working harder. But the challenge that really has been unearthed during this pandemic is that the majority of the household work also falls on women. When we were losing childcare, when kids were doing virtual learning, when people had to quarantine, it's been proven in studies that oftentimes that domestic work and caring for elderly family members or the sandwich generation, people who have to take care of their kids and the older generation, that work has stereotypically, traditionally, and continues to predominantly fall on women. And so what happens is we see women leaving the workforce in droves because they're getting burnt out at work because of an ongoing pandemic. They're getting burnt out at home because now they have all of these extra things that they need to be worrying about at home. That's not to say that they're, if they have a male partner, they're not stepping up as well. But again, the majority of this work, and it's been proven, research has shown, the majority of that work does continue to fall on women. So what we need to really emphasize is thinking of ways that this pandemic can create a better system. We need to start thinking about childcare. We need to start thinking about being intentional in who we're sponsoring. We need to look at the work that people are doing and not just look at the traditional ways that we say this person has published X number of papers, they're ready for promotion. It should be, okay, well, this person may not have published as many papers, but look at all of the community service work they did for our institutions. So I think we're at a watershed moment right now where we can really look at all of the inequities that have been laid bare by this pandemic. We've known they're there. The data has been there for years. So it's not that we don't know what the problems are, but we should take a really deep, hard look at our institutions and say, what are the solutions we can come up with to come out of this pandemic? We know childcare is an issue for those who have children. We know that promotion and tenure committees often don't value some of this work that's necessary. How do we change that? We know that a lot of the time, this extra work that women are doing, it's being done in what we deem the third shift. So the first shift is your regular job. The second shift is the job you're doing at home. And then the third shift is all of this extra work that you're doing that's not compensated. That's often done between 11 p.m. and 2 a.m. That's when I get a lot of my third shift work done. And then Dr. Julie Silver described a fourth shift, which happened with this pandemic, which is all of the COVID-19 work that's often not being not being acknowledged or and getting any benefit from. So we need to figure out how to pay people for that type of third shift and fourth shift work. We need to figure out how to make sure that is also going towards promotions. We also need to make sure that our leadership is diverse. So now is the time to really take a look at the leadership within your organizations and determine, is this leadership representative of the rest of the workforce? And is it representative of the patients that we are taking care of? Because at the end of the day, our goal is to provide exceptional patient care. And what we found is that when you have diverse leadership and leadership that's representative of the communities you're serving, you actually have better patient outcomes. You have better retention of your healthcare workforce. You actually have a better overall healthcare system that is run as a better organization that's more representative of the community that it's serving. There's also been data that's been shown relatively recently where women have actually been found to have lower readmission rates when it comes to hospital medicine. There was a study that came out showing that women surgeons actually had less complications when they were taking care of women patients as compared to their male colleagues. And again, this is not a competition. It's just to show providing the diversity of leadership and the diversity within your workforce is going to, at the end of the day, be better for your organizations. I have to add one caveat in here. In a lot of these discussions, we talk in the binary where we talk about male, female, women, men. Now, obviously, that is not encompassing all of our population. There are a lot of people who are non-binary, who are gender fluid. So we need to make sure that we also include those individuals in these discussions. Unfortunately, the majority of the research and data that we have looks at the binary, looks at male, female, man, woman. And so that's why I refer to these topics in that space. But I think I would be, it would not be covering the breadth of information if we don't talk about the fact that there are people who would not identify in those two categories. And we need to make sure that they are also included when we talk about diversifying our workforce.
And then looking towards your article again, in the article you write, when interviewing for a job, I was told I should plan to only work part-time indefinitely and not plan for any career growth as they were sure I would want to have another baby anytime now. So looking at this statement, can you elaborate maybe on the dangers of perpetuating this mentality in the workforce?
It's a huge, huge problem when we try to dictate what women in the workforce should be doing when it comes to their personal lives. There are some women who don't want to have children. There's some women who can't have children. There are some women who want 10 children or more. And that is their decision. And it is also their decision to decide how are they going to incorporate their work life and their home life into their overall life. That is not something that we as employers or as colleagues should be commenting on. The real question is this person going to be a hard worker? Are they a good worker? And are they capable for the task that they are interviewing for? And I think the real challenge becomes when you're talking to women who are entering the workforce or who are looking for a new position, a lot of times these ideas of pay or the need to not pay women as much because they aren't the primary breadwinner. That's not always the case. And even if that isn't the case, whether that is or isn't the case, women and men and everyone should be getting paid for the job that they are performing. They should be getting paid equitably and equally. So it doesn't make sense to ask these types of things or to impose your own personal views on what other people should be doing. A lot of times there's microaggressions we talk about and macroaggressions where there's explicit bias and implicit bias. These are all words we use to describe these types of conversations. I mean, I could spend hours telling you about the things that have happened to me and my colleagues. When I was pregnant with twins, somebody came up to me and said, that wasn't supposed to happen. And I said, do you need me to explain to you the biology of pregnancy? So it was, it just becomes a conversation that is uncomfortable. It's unnecessary. It devalues and demoralizes the people that you're speaking with. And at the end of the day, again, a person's personal choices for what they want to do with their family or with their body should not come into play when we talk about employment. And a lot of the things that are asked are actually illegal. It's not legal to ask somebody, are they planning on having children or what their plan is for family in the future when you're interviewing for a job. Unfortunately, people still do it. I think we really lose some amazing women from the workforce and from ambitious women with goals for large careers. We lose them because of these micro and macro aggressions, not only because they aren't given the opportunities that are given to colleagues who may not be even as qualified, but simply aren't women. And I think that not only that, we also lose these women because at the end of the day, if they feel like their work is not being valued, or if they feel that they're being treated as somebody who is not equal because they may have chosen to have children or gotten pregnant during a time that was not convenient for their boss or their colleagues. I think we're really losing some amazing minds, and we're losing the opportunity to really create special healthcare systems that are productive and that are that have great workforce retention and that are providing exceptional care for patients. And so we really need to think about how we communicate with everyone that we work with, because these types of things can chase people out of the field altogether.
Looking at this, how do microaggressions and what you term the whisper network perpetuate the treatment of women in medicine?
Well, there are a lot of different types of microaggressions that exist. We published a paper a few years ago looking at the American Society for Clinical Oncology and speaker introductions. And what we found was that women were more likely to be introduced by first name as compared to men. And what happens with a microaggression like this is when you are up on a stage and you hear Dr. Smith, Dr. Jones, Kim, and Jessica, automatically, Dr. Smith and Dr. Jones are seen as experts, and no one knows what Kim and Jessica's expertise is. That can have a direct impact on the individual's career growth, because Kim and Jessica may not be asked to speak at another conference, but Dr. Smith and Jones may, because they're seen as experts. Not only that, it can really lead to feelings of inadequacy or feeling like you're not good enough. It can feed into and fuel that imposter phenomenon that many ambitious women and men feel when you're not being treated as an equal with people who you're sitting on a stage with. So that's one way to which microaggressions can really impact people's career growth. And that's just one very small example. When you talk about the whisper network, what happens in society, and we've seen it play out in healthcare and in the national stage, is when there is an individual who another individual may not like or may not agree with their life choices or with their professional choices, there is a very well-known whisper network where people start spreading rumors, and all of a sudden a person's reputation comes under fire. Unfortunately, what we found is oftentimes when things like this occur, if a woman is targeted, her career is often derailed, and the male who is either doing the targeting or who is accused of doing something often fails up. So there was a very prominent GI oncologist relatively recently who for years was able to use his whisper network and use his connections to continue to allegedly abuse and really destroy the careers of many women who he worked with. And the sad thing is we see this all the time, where those types of men are then able to fail up, where they get new opportunities or new jobs, new promotions at other institutions. And that continues to happen, while the women who are targeted often are not supported. They are their career trajectories are completely go off the rails, and in some cases even leave medicine altogether. And so that whisper network, it becomes almost a way to help the people who are accused, and it ends up being a career killer for those who are trying to do the right thing. And so when it comes to healthcare, just as with society, we need to start holding people accountable. We need to have better systems in place when women come with concerns, when women come with allegations, there needs to be a way to investigate, and there needs to be repercussions when these things come to light, as opposed to sweeping things under the rug and constantly allowing these individuals who may bring in a lot of funding, who may be nationally or internationally renowned. There needs to be a way to make sure that they are not continuing to succeed while the people who brought to light the concerns relating to them, those women are not basically destroyed.
Looking at this idea of failing up, you also write that the accused are given a pass because of the funding they generate or their national reputation. And you, again, like you just spoke on, you cited two examples of reported harassment that went unchecked for far too long. So looking at everything you just said and these citations you spoke on in your article here, how can we get away from the valuation of gains over morals in these cases?
Well, that's the hard question, because when it comes to institutions, obviously there's always a bottom line to look at, and they need to be looking at finances and who's bringing in funding and who's bringing a national reputation to institutions. So I understand that. I'm not claiming that that's not important. Unfortunately, what is happening is that somehow has taken precedence over a moral compass. And obviously, you can't just assume everyone who makes an allegation is honest. You need to investigate allegations. And I think that is something that often doesn't happen, where allegations are made, people are told that there will be repercussions, and those repercussions don't ever come to fruition, and the person just leaves the institution quietly for another position. So there needs to be a way to hold people accountable. There needs to be a way to realize that while the bottom line is important, keeping your healthcare workers allegations, making sure they feel heard, making sure that those types of things are not only well investigated, but that there are repercussions when investigations occur and people are held accountable for inappropriate behavior. That is going to take a culture change. It's going to take a systems change. And it's going to take allies. More than anything, the biggest thing that I talk about when I talk about these topics is we don't need just women doing this work. This work needs to be done by our allies who are in leadership positions. And the word that's tossed around a lot now, which I really like, is accomplices. We don't just need allies, we also need accomplices. We need people in these positions of power and leadership to lead the charge when it comes to these types of problems. We need them to be looking inwardly and looking within their institutions and saying, where can we fix things? Where are the challenges? They need to be sitting down and making room at the table for people who've been doing this work for years to identify where are the pressure points in our organization and how can we fix them. I also want to emphasize the fact that for those with intersectional identities, this is an even bigger problem. We talk about minority taxes, mommy taxes. There are so many amazing individuals out there who have intersectional identities who are targeted from multiple angles. And so we need allies and accomplices who are sitting at the table, who are creating the opportunities for these individuals, and who are addressing these things head on. Because until we have people who are already in leadership, leading the charge and sitting in these committees and coming to these meetings and going to women in ... meetings so that they understand the problems that exist, until they do a deep dive and realize that they need to be leading the charge, change is not going to happen, because change needs to come from the top, and the top needs to understand that this needs to be a priority in order for us to rescue our healthcare system from these pervasive inequities that are contributing to this great resignation that we're seeing in the healthcare system and the healthcare workforce.
Looking now to the Women in Medicine Summit and Women in Medicine, or WIM, what served as the basis for starting this up, and what are the goals of these programs?
So I started the Women in Medicine Summit a couple years ago when I realized that a lot of women were having the same challenges that I had faced. And some were having way more challenges than I had faced because they weren't fortunate enough to have a support system or a network that could help them navigate the barriers that they were encountering. So I launched the Women in Medicine Summit, and our first in-person conference was in 2019. And it's a two-day CME conference that takes place in Chicago. And the purpose is to empower the attendees to learn leadership skills, to learn negotiation tactics, to learn how to be an ally, and figure out how to apply these types of skills to their own professional and personal lives, but then also take these skills and change the systems within which they work. work, whether it's their subspecialty society or whether it's their organization, and take these skills back and take these concepts and these toolkits back and teach them to others to show how we can really disrupt and improve the healthcare system. We also strongly encourage our male allies to attend the summit because we do a lot of programming for allyship to make sure that men are also leading the charge. We have then through the Women in Medicine nonprofit, the other organization that I run, that was formed during the pandemic. And it was kind of formed off of the concept of the summit, where we realized there was a lot of programming that was needed, not only in a two-day conference, but also longitudinal programming. So with the Women in Medicine nonprofit, we have three different leadership programs. Two are for women. One is for early career women. One is for mid-career women. And it's really meant to accelerate their paths into leadership. And again, these are CME courses that are virtual, predominantly virtual, with a networking opportunity at the summit itself. The third course is one that is the first of its kind, and it's the Women in Medicine He for She Inclusive Leadership Lab for male leaders. And this year, we're actually offering the first 2 days of that CME program, leadership program, at the summit, and the rest will be virtual. And our first cohort was just phenomenal. The purpose of the Inclusive Leadership Lab is to have men really gain those skills as to how they can be allies and accomplices and how they can disrupt the system from within and how they can really work towards creating more diverse and equitable systems. And we do that by creating a leadership course that teaches you how to be a more inclusive leader. The allyship program actually came from a bunch of men coming to me and asking me, how can we be better at this? We want to help. We want to change the system. What do we need to do? And I said, that's a great question. We should create programming for that. So we have these two men, these two PhDs who are just phenomenal experts in the space. They've written multiple books on the topic. And so they lead our Inclusive Leadership Lab. And we're already seeing the changes that the men who were in the cohort last year are implementing already. The nonprofit also has great ways to empower women. We have a speakers bureau. We have a research lab. We really created the nonprofit with the idea that we don't just need to empower women. We also need to apply the concept of providing them opportunities. So our speakers bureau and our research lab offers them opportunities for speaking opportunities and for publications. Our research lab really focuses on solutions. So we're looking at how to change the system, looking at the data that's already out there and coming up with real world solutions. So our Women in Medicine nonprofit is founded on these different pillars of education, mentorship and sponsorship, creating thought leadership opportunities, creating allyship programming, and at the end of the day, creating networks and communities for women and men across the country and even internationally who can use the support network to advance their own careers and improve the system from within, and also just do a little bit of disrupting while we're trying to create a more equitable healthcare system for everyone.
If there was anything to emphasize about this topic, what would be one big, I guess, take-home message you'd like to really leave colleagues and anybody who's listening with?
The biggest message, I think, the biggest take-home point from all of this is we are at a watershed moment in healthcare. We are seeing healthcare workers burn out left, right, and center. We're seeing so many people leave the healthcare workforce. Creating a healthcare system that is going to be sustainable, that's going to keep our best and brightest within the healthcare system, is an absolute must right now. Not only because the healthcare workforce needs it, but our patients and our communities need it. We are not able to provide exceptional care to our patients when we do not have a workforce that is happy and healthy and wants to stay doing what they're doing. We need to inspire our next generation of healthcare leaders, and we need to continue to support our current healthcare leaders. This work is so important right now. I don't think there's anything else that needs to be focused on more than this. And when I say this, what I mean is creating equitable workforces that are sustainable. We need to make sure that we are taking this moment in time, we are taking the last 3 years, and we are learning from our mistakes, and we are working towards creating a healthcare system that is sustainable. Because our healthcare workers are at a breaking point. Men, women, everyone is at a point now where we need to do something drastic and we need to do it soon. And so everyone should be focusing on trying to fix the healthcare system. And one of the central tenets of fixing the healthcare system is making sure we have an equitable healthcare system, not only so we can provide equitable care to our patients, but also so that we can retain our healthcare workforce and continue to do what we do best, which is take care of patients in innovative ways and provide the best care that we can. The Women in Medicine Summit is September 16th and 17th. It will be in person this year in Chicago. So I hope that many of you can attend. As I said, it's open to everyone. You don't have to be a woman in medicine to join. We would love to see many of you there. We would love for you to check out our Women in Medicine Speakers Bureau. And if you're interested in getting involved in any of our initiatives or signing up for any of our leadership programming, please feel free to reach out. I'm happy to connect anyone with any of our programming, and I look forward to seeing all of you hopefully in September.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of Onc Life on Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclife.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. Onc Life is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and at OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms, so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Onc Live on Air.